Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. No, I have not changed the theme music for the show. For those of you who love it and for those of you who don't, sorry to disappoint you. The music you just heard was composed algorithmically from the raw genetic data from the serotonin transporter, 5-HTT. That's just one of the many ancillary offshoots of the Human Genome Project. It's an endeavor that cost $3 billion and took 13 years to sequence the 3 billion units in a single human genome. Since completing that task in 2005, the cost to sequence a human genome has fallen to as little as $1,000, and the time required to amass that 3.2 gigabytes of data now, about 2 hours, according to the biotech company IonTorrent. The goal is to identify and treat the genetic roots of disease with strategies tailored to fit the individual. But this brave new world is not without its logistical and ethical obstacles. One issue is the so-called direct-to-consumer genetic testing. Question for our listeners. Have you had your own personalized genetic testing done? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call and tell us your story. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also post your question or comment on Facebook. Coming up later, we're going to hear from a genetics expert who has reservations about this information breakthrough, saying that individual testing doesn't provide the best picture of an individual's risk for complex diseases. And a bioethicist will talk about some of the ethical issues raised by personal genetics testing. Should people always be told the results of genome screenings? And should insurance companies, employers, and others have access to the information? Joining us now is Kevin Sweet. He's a certified genetics counselor and associate professor of human genetics at the Ohio State University Department of Internal Medicine, Comprehensive Cancer Center. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thanks, Ann. Glad to be here.
You're the co-author of two recent books, Your Genes, Your Health, and Personalized Medicine, and The Busy Physician's Guide to Genetics, Genomics, and Personalized Medicine. The most important purpose of individualized genetic testing is personalized treatments, right? Personalized medicine. What does that mean?
Well, personalized medicine is kind of a broad term. But ideally, if one can gather, based through a person's genetic makeup, along with non-genetic influences, say, their environmental risk factors, lifestyle, even factors like family history, to determine both an individual's risk for potentially developing disease, but then also if they develop a disease, how to better maybe tailor treatment towards that. So say a certain form of cancer, breast cancer. Not every individual with breast cancer is going to respond the same to different treatments. So if you could potentially understand what type of cancer they have, their age, their potential response to certain treatments, you could potentially personalize their care or personalize their medicine.
Now, we were talking a little bit earlier about what an explosion this is. I mean, to go down to just even a thousand or even a few thousand dollars in so short a time is amazing to the average person. Maybe not if you've been following it closely all this time. And also the idea, the amount of data that comes with it. How many people, what do we know about who is doing this and how popular or typical is it to have your own genome?
Indeed. I would say probably in the last 3 to 5 years is where the, you could say almost explosion of genetic information and availability of getting more genetic data has come about. And primarily because of just advances in technology to look at not just, say, a single gene or a few genes, but literally millions or billions of genetic data points in a given individual. The ability to do that, you can do it more rapidly and much more cost-effectively now. And there are companies called direct-to-consumer companies or services, which about a few years ago, there's only a handful now, but they're starting to offer to the general public these types of genetic services. You can send a saliva sample with your consent, and they can look at some of your genetic variation. There's positives and negatives to this. There's a lot of limitations with regard to, although we can do the analysis, these companies can do this analysis, what actually does it mean? Some of the genetic determinants that a test might provide may only increase risk for a certain disease a little bit. And what about other non-genetic influences with regard to that risk? So it may not be the full story. some of what's available is definitely driving progress with regard to research. So in certain fields like cancer, just the ability to look at more and more genetic data points within even a person's tumor allows us to better personalize care. So there's good and bad aspects to it. I think a large part of what we're trying to strive for is just education as far as where things are at, what technologies are available, what tests or personalized medicine services might be helpful to you. Also stressing even the importance of family history. Although there's genetic tests available, even looking at a family history is really still the gold standard with regard to helping assess a person's risk for both rare and common disease.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kevin Sweet. He's a certified genetics counselor and associate professor of human genetics at OSU. We're talking about the Human Genome Project and what it's brought to us, which is direct-to-consumer genetic reports, personal genetic reports. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. What does one of these reports look like? I pay $1,000 or whatever the charge is, and they send me, I send them my saliva sample, but what do they send me back?
Well, actually, if we're talking just about the direct-to-consumer companies offering these services, they don't give you everything, number one. A lot of it is geared towards what is known. Sometimes a term we would use is called association. So you might have a genetic variant associated with risk for, say, Crohn's disease or type 2 diabetes. So certain companies, and a lot of these being available online, your reports are also available online. So you go to a secure website, you know, enter your password, and receive reports. Some of the companies may only offer reports on a certain number of diseases. Some are more extensive. There's one company that offers reports on about 150, 180 different diseases now. And then the report itself, many times it states what genetic variant you might have. The caveat here is that's only one single genetic point. There might be more data even within the test that was run that might not be incorporated yet. So it might not be the complete report you're hoping for. Sometimes these are for certain traits and also for certain risks for different diseases.
Is this something you order up when you send them your saliva, what you want to know about? Or do just different companies provide, they make the decision about what they're going to send you?
You know, I'd have to say that most of the services available right now, the company itself decides what might be more helpful. Certain companies, certain organizations may provide more actionable type of results versus more recreational type of genetic results. I think it varies a little bit. And also, I think an important term, and a term we are starting to use more and more in the field, only certain people really might even want this information. We call them early adopters, but Individuals maybe for whatever reason, they're trying to learn more about their risk for certain diseases or maybe to better understand aspects of how they can increase their health.
Usually they tend to be very highly educated.
Correct.
Relatively affluent because it has been more expensive than it is now. And they're just curious. They're into science. They're science buffs.
I think there's a lot of curiosity out there. And also sometimes even a lack of awareness because there is no one genetic test that can tell you everything. Maybe down the road there might be, but we're talking, you know, maybe even decades. We're making progress towards that. And also I think it's really important to understand that all disease is complex. It's not just a genetic component, but there's, again, other factors, non-genetic factors, that have a very important part with regard to your risk.
What kind of cautions do you give consumers about this kind of a thing? In other words, you talked about research and how the accumulation of all this data can really help clinically, you know, in the research field. But when you order up one of these things, you pay for it. Isn't it private or is it automatically submitted to, you know, larger databases?
Again, I think it depends on the setting. So with regard to if you're part of a research study and through the process of informed consent, there are sometimes processes where your data could be de-identified and shared with other researchers because indeed our ability to glean from all of this genetic data becomes more powerful if we can lump more and more individuals together. We're looking for certain differences and characteristics and also similar changes within a DNA that might be associated with different diseases. But then there's some companies, even direct-to-consumer companies, which really do not share data. It's really more of a service that they provide. I guess it kind of depends on what you're being involved with and, you know, what you want to get out from it. But I think it's important, very important point is when you receive or have any type of genetic test done to, you know, be as informed as possible, to ideally maybe even work with your healthcare provider in trying to understand, well, what does this actually mean? Is this a useful test for me? There are definitely limitations to a lot of the tests that are out there. Interpretation even of the test is not that straightforward. So again, I think it's important if you're interested in having these types of tests done, and I think they're becoming even more available in the future, to make sure you understand what you're getting into and what the results might mean, and even how that might be shared with regard to research. You can sometimes opt into different research. There's a company that's doing research on Parkinson's disease, and they're hoping to gather more data on individuals and look at that.
Elizabeth in New Concord, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you for taking my call. Michael, I'm an adoptee in my 50s, and I just had a question about whether or not what his thoughts are about adoptees doing that. I was actually diagnosed with osteoporosis about 8 years ago and didn't fit the profile, and I wanted to be tested just to make sure I didn't have that problem later on, and lo and behold, had it. So it's always a thought in my mind about what I might be, predisposed to.
Kevin Sweet?
Yeah, actually being an adoptee does make it a little bit more difficult because you don't have a family history, known family history to fall back on with regard to knowing risks for, different diseases. And in some circumstances like that, maybe having different types of genetic tests could potentially provide additional information for risk for diseases like osteoporosis. I guess I'm still somewhat on the fence. Again, depending on your circumstances, depending on what you may value and what you may want from these different types of tests. And again, I think interpretation is important. There are some genetic variants known with regard to risk for diseases like osteoporosis, but they may only confer a small amount of risk. And that in and of by itself may not be, again, the complete picture. So, I think there's some value to some of these tests. It's really kind of in the context of what an individual might want and what they're hoping to get out of it.
Thanks, Elizabeth, for that call.
Thank you.
You've also, and I know you have to leave right away, but you've also co-authored a book for physicians.
Yes.
Why was that necessary?
Early on in the process, and I guess the process in my mind, probably about 3-4 years ago, I kind of felt that things were changing rapidly in our field. Again, just with advances and the ability of more and more genetic tests to become available. And I was actually at a personalized healthcare conference here at Ohio State, and one of the researchers in the audience commented that there's about 800,000 MDs, physicians across the country. And a lot of them may not be up to speed with regard to what's happening in the field of genetics and genetic advances and personalized medicine. And that was kind of the prompting for writing this book, with the hope that we can also help educate not only physicians but other healthcare professionals with advances and where things are now and where they're going and how to potentially interpret these reports. And also, when their patients come to them, if they have this type of testing themselves or if they want different types of testing, how to help them understand or maybe refer and help them ease them into the process.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's Kevin Sweet. He's a certified genetics counselor and associate professor of human genetics at OSU. He's also the author of two books on the topic. The first one is called Your Genes, Your Health, and Personalized Medicine, and the second one, The Busy Physician's Guide to Genetics, Genomics, and Personalized Medicine. Stay with us. We'll continue the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
You can support WOSU Public Media by becoming a volunteer. We're looking for volunteers to take calls of support from listeners during our upcoming spring membership drive. If you're interested in becoming a volunteer, just visit WOSU.org/volunteers or call 614-292-9678.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
42 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 56. And then cold tonight, a low of 29 degrees with widespread frost. Sunshine for Saturday morning, warming up to a high of 63. Cloud Saturday night, a low of 42, and then a chance of rain on Sunday, a high of 62. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
That music was composed algorithmically from the raw genetic data from the mosquito olfactory receptor AGOR1. So there you go. Music from a mosquito. It's not just a buzzing sound. That's just one of many ancillary offshoots of the Human Genome Project, an endeavor that cost $3 billion and took 13 years to sequence the 3 billion units in a single human genome. Soon, the same task will take just a few hours and cost little more than $1,000, maybe less in just a few years' time. Today on All Sides, we're talking about the medical and ethical issues connected to personalized direct-to-consumer genetics testing. Joining us now is Amy Sturm. She's a certified genetics counselor and an assistant professor of human genetics at The Ohio State University Department of Internal Medicine Medical Genetics Program. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us is Michelle McGowan. She's an assistant professor of bioethics at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. She's a member of the Gender and Women's Studies Program faculty. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you.
You know, a few things I didn't get to when Kevin Sweet was with us and I wanted to was why people do this. And I know, Michelle, that's something you've studied in the past. I wanted to get into that a little bit more deeply because there's people who are just science buffs. Maybe they're medically savvy. They're already in the medical field. But what more do we know about what's driving people to, in some cases, spend several thousand dollars? It's going to get cheap, but it isn't cheap yet.
Right. So as you mentioned, early adopters are one of the constituencies that are most likely to pursue personalized genetic testing and other new technologies when they first enter the market. But some of the other constituencies that we found in our study that were interested in pursuing personalized genetic testing were people who are interested in finding ways to prevent future health problems and who are also interested in promoting their current health. So they were interested in the health-related information that direct-to-consumer genetic testing could provide for them. And in addition to that, there is also a large market of individuals who are interested in genetic ancestry testing, and we found that they were an existing market who have now moved into the arena of personalized genetic testing because some of the companies do offer ancestry mapping based on, you know, genetic origins of particular populations.
Is that the test that traces us all back to a single woman somewhere in the African continent? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, this particular test that I'm just mentioned is through the company 23andMe, which has done genetic testing based on international research that's been conducted to try to find genetic origin populations all around the world. So it's not just in one place, but to try to trace people from different continents and regions within continents.
Amy Sturm, you're concerned about a lot of things regarding not genetic testing in general, but the idea of personal direct-to-consumer tests, that people get this direct to the consumer. What's your greatest concern about this? And do you think that might change over time?
Yeah, I think that, there are some potential benefits to this type of information. And there's a lot of work looking into a new term that has kind of been coined called personal utility of this information, and kind of playing off of what Michelle said, will people want to maybe even use this type of information to motivate them toward positive behavior changes? But I can speak just personally from one of the genetic counseling sessions that I've had with a person who actually utilized a direct-to-consumer genomic test. And it was very interesting because he didn't necessarily fit the criteria of what we think of as these necessary early adopters, as far as being a little bit more highly educated, more affluent, and having more resources. And he actually went into it straight from, like Michelle said, one of these kind of newer user groups, primarily because he was most interested in his ancestry. And he really was curious to do more ancestry testing. This company happened to have a special going on where it was $99. And he thought, hey, that's a great deal.
Kind of like LASIK surgery or something.
Exactly.
Now, right?
You know, it kind of was advertised right around Christmas time. And he decided, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm really interested in my ancestry. Well, lo and behold, he sent off his saliva. He got his reports back, and he got the report information back to him. And he had a difficult time really understanding what some of the information was telling him. So he sought out us at Ohio State, our genetics department, to schedule a genetic counseling appointment. And it was really fascinating. I really couldn't have written this story myself if it was a fake story, because his results and the way that they matched up with his family history and what we would recommend to him based on our medical expertise compared to what he thought he needed based on the results was really just fascinating. And that's been one of the potential concerns that we're worried we might see, is potential overutilization of the medical system. If someone's getting these types of reports and they tell you, oh, you have an increased risk for, you know, a certain type of cancer, will that person then be going to their primary care physician and saying, I want this test, when really the relative risk this genetic variant gives them might be a few fold and not be giving them a really high risk where they need more testing?
And this wouldn't necessarily, number one, this kind of testing is not covered by insurance.
No, unless, and that's the interesting thing, right? I mean, people are paying out of their own pockets for this genetic test, and then they're wondering, do I need maybe more medical screenings for this? But they're paying out of pocket for the actual genetic testing. But then, of course, we would want the health insurance to cover screenings if they were necessary.
And Michelle, the testing company isn't liable necessarily for what they send to you. In other words, right. The insurance company can't come back to them and say, you should not be telling somebody, you know, or the doctor. No one can go back to them, can they yet?
Right. At this point in time, these consumer genomic companies aren't very strictly regulated. In the U.S. context, we have there's a lag behind regulation of genetic testing laboratories that are not doing clinical testing. And so because these direct-to-consumer testing markets fall outside of the clinical sector, they haven't been subject to a lot of the same scrutiny, although there has been in the last few years a couple of instances where states like New York and California have sent letters, warning letters to these companies saying, you know, you're really dispensing medical information and you're not medical practitioners. So they've gotten cease and desist letters from state health boards. And so there is, there has been some spotty movement to try to regulate these types of companies. But right now, there really is sort of a gap.
We're talking about the medical and ethical issues connected to personalized direct-to-consumer genetics testing. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question for either of our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm talking right now with Michelle McGowan. She's an assistant professor of bioethics at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. And also with me here in the studio, Amy Sturm. She's a certified genetics counselor and an assistant professor of human genetics at the OSU Department of Internal Medicine. 614-292-8513 is the number to call, or you can email me at allsides@wosu.org. And if you've had the personalized genetics testing done, if you've done this direct-to-consumer purchase, give us a call and tell us what you thought. 614-292-8513. So, Michelle, I read that some states, several states actually, limit or forbid direct-to-consumer genetic testing. Is that the case? Is that true? And is that true in Ohio?
As far as I'm aware, Ohio doesn't have any such regulation. And if this is happening, it's a more recent phenomenon. It's true that in Europe, a number of countries have forbade the direct-to-consumer availability of genetic testing.
And what's why? Why are they doing that there, but in Ohio, they're not? What's the thought?
You know, I think that's a pretty interesting question, and I don't know that there's a straight answer for it. I think that some have speculated that that genetics should be contained within the medical industry complex, and so the direct-to-consumer market is leapfrogging over the traditional model of translating research into clinical practice by offering something outside of that trajectory. So, you know, one position is that, you know, they are rogue in their approach, and so that is why some countries and states are regulating the practice of dispensing commercial products.
Amy Sturm, your colleague, Kevin Sweet, we just talked to him. He's co-authored two books, one for the everyday consumer, it sounds like, and another for physicians. What are you concerned that says it's okay and everything's okay if those kind of books, the how-to books, come out?
Oh, definitely not. I think the how-to books are exactly what we need.
Okay.
Because they're also, especially with physicians, there have been recent large national surveys of physicians asking them, do they think certain genetic and genomic information is important? And they all resoundingly say, yes, we want to. We think this type of information is important. But then when you ask them the follow-up question, do you feel confident that you can incorporate this into your medical practice today? The number is very small. And so there's also a very huge gap between the amount of knowledge we have about genetics and genomics and how much of that is actually being incorporated into everyday care with your primary care physicians, family physicians, those doctors that are taking care of patients on the front line. So I think part of definitely what Kevin and myself are trying to do is not only take care of the patients we see for even more traditional types of genetics, but educate physicians, other healthcare providers, and the public, the consumers, about the importance of this information, because a lot of it can be very clinically actionable right now. And I think that especially just how quickly our technology is growing, we within the next few years will just be learning more and more things that we can incorporate and even put right into a patient's electronic medical record and act upon.
Michelle, though, this still, again, going back to the insurance companies, and don't let me get off the insurance companies, there's another obvious question there coming up, but they don't compensate physicians for having these discussions with people when they bring in their personalized genetic profile. They don't. That can take a lot of time to go over something like that with somebody, but the physicians aren't compensated by the insurance companies, are they?
Right. So this is one of the challenges that Amy pointed to, this concept of the raid on the medical commons that has been speculated that might occur if people start flooding the healthcare institutions with the results of these direct-to-consumer tests. This has been a concern since probably 2008 that was published in the literature, and there's been a lot of speculation since then about what the impact of direct-to-consumer testing would be on the physician and also on insurability of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So could there be some loopholes in the federal regulations, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, that would impact individuals' insurability if they were to have their privately tested results made public in some way? And so this is a concern. Another concern that has been raised, I think, more from within the medical community itself than from fields like bioethics, is that, you know, there aren't mechanisms in the billing processes that are currently in place in the healthcare system in the U.S. for billing for new genetic tests and companion diagnostics that are actually emerging in the clinical sector as well. So there is a bit of a bottleneck between the availability of testing and coverage for these types of tests and therapeutics that may come from new genomic information as far as insurance companies are concerned.
Madeline in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Madeline.
Hi, I just wanted to speak very briefly in support of this whole idea. I am a participant in the Coriell personalized study, genomic study. So I, you know, gobbled up my spit, gave it to them. And
Thank you very much. We appreciate that.
And, you know, quite frankly, I have absolutely no concern about this stuff. You know, the insurance companies getting a hold of it. Pooey on that. There's so much information out there. That's last of my concerns. But the thing is, if this testing could ever pinpoint something on the genes that says, yes, you have this brain disorder, commonly called mental illness. You know, you have this brain disorder called major depression. You have this brain disorder called panic. You have this brain disorder called anxiety. If someone could say, look, look right here, here's proof. Because these illnesses, the mental illnesses, the brain illnesses, it's so hard to convince someone they have it. There's no test for it. So if you could find some sort of a genetic...
There's no biological test for
exactly,
it.
Exactly,
yeah.
Yes. And there are so many families that suffer and struggle, and if they could have genetic testing that said, yes, look at this, look at your dad, look at this brother, look at this nephew, look at this uncle. So anyway, I'm very much in support of this, and I think it's a wicked cool study. and that's my 2 cents, and I'll listen on offline.
Thank you, Madeline, for your call. Amy, I mean, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, and actually, I'm one of the, myself and Kevin are the two genetic counselors running that protocol here at Ohio State, and so thank you so much for participating in our research. And, you know, I've heard so many patients voice very similar things to what you just said as far as when they finally get that genetic diagnosis, it's actually something they're somewhat happy about because they now know why, you know, they have this disease. They now know that there really is something real that they are being diagnosed with because some genetic conditions are very rare. It takes a long time for people to get diagnosed. And when they finally get that genetic answer and they learn, this is really something going on in me, now I know why, I can understand it better, that's a huge piece of important information for patients. And I think you have the mindset that a lot of the individuals who are signing on to do the Coriell Personalized Medicine Collaborative Research Study have, that they want to learn as much as possible for themselves and also for the greater good for society. And actually, the larger Coriell Personalized Medicine Collaborative out of New Jersey, who is our collaborator on this research study, now has thousands of participants who really, in many ways, sought them out because they wanted to give them their spit. They said, here, here's my saliva, analyze me, give me any information. And so there are a lot of people who are very excited and want to participate in this type of research and are excited about the results they're getting back.
We are talking about making it a very regular part of everyday life to know what you're made of. Literally, it's cheaper. It doesn't take as much time. But how is it happening? Is it happening too fast? How well do we understand what we're looking at when we get our personalized genetic testing done? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, All Sides Weekend begins with host Marilyn Smith and a discussion of the best restaurants in Central Ohio. Stay with us for All Sides Weekend from 11 till noon.
Hey, did you hear Car Talk last week?
Well, I have even a crazier idea.
Okay. I was hoping for some sort of dangerous chemical solvent.
That's exactly what I'm about to recommend, Josh.
Dangerous chemical solvent?
You'll need,
that is better.
The first thing you need to do is go to the local Army-Navy store and buy yourself one of those gas masks.
Don't miss the fun this week.
Join us for Car Talk.
Car Talk tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. 45 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, and a high of 56. Clear skies for tonight, but cold, a low of 29 degrees with widespread frost throughout much of the area. Sunshine for Saturday, warming back up to a high of 63. Increasing clouds Saturday night, a low of 42. A chance of rain for Sunday morning, clouds in the afternoon, a high of 62.
Support for 89.7 comes from Marburn Academy, a leader in ADHD and dyslexic education, inviting you to an evening open house April 9th and a community seminar on the role of medication April 10th. More information at marburnacademy.org.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The music you just heard was composed algorithmically from raw genetic data from the PTC taste receptor, of all things. Today, it kind of made me a little hungry. I don't know. Today on All Sides, we're talking about the medical and ethical issues connected to personalized, direct-to-consumer genetics testing. Still with us is Amy Sturm. She's a certified genetics counselor and assistant professor of human genetics at Ohio State University's Department of Internal Medicine in their medical genetics program. Once again, Amy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And also still with us is Michelle McGowan. She's an assistant professor of bioethics at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine and a member of the Gender and Women's Studies Program faculty. Once again, Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I wanted to go back to the insurance question before we get to some of these calls and a couple emails. You know, Madeline said pooey on the insurance companies, it doesn't matter. There was one issue we've already talked about, which is insurance coverage of this, of these kinds of tests and this kind of post-testing counseling with your physician, which at this point is not covered for all intents and purposes. But beyond that, what about insurance companies demanding? You've had the test done. Can't they ask you if you've had it, you must divulge it before to get insured? It go down that route?
I guess it's a possibility that they could go down that route, but there is a piece of legislation in place at the federal level, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, that is meant to protect genetic information that has previously been used to discriminate against prospective insurance clients. Mm-hmm. And so there is, this was passed in 2008 and is meant to anticipate some of the challenges that you're foreshadowing here, that there might be with the advent of more and more genetic information available, the potential for insurance companies to try to exploit that. However, there are some loopholes in the legislation, particularly in the area of long-term care insurance. And so it is still possible to discriminate against patients who are trying to get long-term care insurance if they do have a known genetic condition or a genetic heritable risk factor for a genetic condition.
Amy Sturm, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, my bread and butter of patients I see at Ohio State is cardiovascular genetics. And a lot of those patients, if they have a certain mutation, have an increased risk for sudden cardiac death. And I was just working with a family over the past few weeks where a woman who has a condition that gives an increased risk for arrhythmias and sudden death has two young daughters under the age of two who, just because they've had an EKG for screening for this condition, they haven't even had genetic testing yet, are already being denied life insurance. And so life insurance is another major area that is not protected by GINA, by that federal law, that we do need to counsel our patient to be aware of. And a lot of times for these conditions where I provide counseling and there is a risk for something in the future to happen to them, we do say try to get your life insurance established now before you have genetic testing, before you get that result. That being said, if a patient tests negative, that can actually be a good thing for them, because then they can go back to their insurance company and say, hey, I tested negative for this disease that is running in my family. Now I should be even more insurable to you. So it could go either ways, but definitely life insurance is another area where we have a huge gap, and unfortunately patients are not currently protected.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Doug in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering if a guest can say anything about any protocols that are being done or research that's being done on trying to counsel people behaviorally to try and perhaps lessen the potential of triggering some of the conditions they might be born with a genetic predisposition to getting. An example would be that, you know, a person who's born with a predisposition to alcoholism isn't going to get it unless they drink alcoholically. And some people who have predispositions to things like bipolar disorder or depression, perhaps those conditions aren't going to be as significant if they can avoid triggers or stimuli that's going to make them react with a profound depression or start to trigger the bipolar.
That is a great question. And actually here at Ohio State, we are conducting a large research study called the Ohio State Coriell Personalized Medicine Collaborative. And we are enrolling people both from the community and then also individuals who specifically have a diagnosis of hypertension, high blood pressure, or congestive heart failure. And we enroll them onto the study. They provide their saliva sample. It goes off to the Coriell facility to have testing. They get a lot of different genetic results back to them through a web portal. And then the way we're running the study is that half of those patients are randomized to meet with a genetic counselor like myself in person. We go through all of the results with them. We go through their family and medical histories with them. And then we make preventive recommendations. And then the other half of the patients in that study are randomized not to meet with a genetic counselor. And so we're really trying to see, can the genetic counseling session have an impact on positive health behavior changes and other outcomes? And we're also working with the physicians of those patients to try to see if bringing the physician into the picture and helping them learn about this genomic information can also have a positive impact long-term on the patient's health.
Glad to hear that. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for the call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want to join the conversation. We have an email from a listener. They write, "My brother died unexpectedly as a teenager from a heart problem called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. That is now known to be genetic. Both I and my children have to be tested for the disorder periodically because the disease is often silent and the first symptom, as with my brother, is sudden death. The tests are expensive and insurance pays for much of the cost. Although some of the genes associated with the illness have been identified, insurance will not pay for genetic testing. In my opinion, it is penny wise and pound foolish for insurance to not pay for genetic testing when they pay almost as much for individuals in my family to be tested in a single year. Is insurance making any progress in this kind of issue?" Michelle McGowan, want to take a stab at that? Okay.
Sure, I'll start first and then Amy can take a stab at it as well.
Okay.
I mean, I think that insurance companies are increasingly aware of the potential benefit of incorporating genetic testing into their coverage areas. However, I think it's a slow road. I was at a conference just last year at the Personalized Medicine Conference at Harvard, where this was a major topic of conversation. And the insurance companies, as well as clinicians, have noticed a lot of the frustration around some of these challenges. You know, there are gaps in the system, like this emailer identified, and it will take time and a lot of bureaucracy to try to change the current system.
Amy Sturm?
Yeah, I have a little bit more of a positive outlook on this just because recently, over the past few years, and I've been working in the field of cardiac genetics, working with patients just like what this man is describing with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy since about 2004. And back at that time when I entered the field, there were very limited testing capabilities. A lot of it was just done on a research basis, and insurance coverage was absolutely abysmal. No one would pay for it. But now, 8 years later, I can say that most of the patients that walk in the door to my clinic, we can get the insurance to cover the testing. Patients may have a copay, but we even work with one laboratory that will limit any out-of-pocket expense to the patient to $100. Even though these tests do cost sometimes thousands of dollars. So I have seen actually a very positive upward trend in the ability and the access of my patients to genetic testing. And I would actually welcome this person to get in touch with our clinic afterwards, and I'd be happy to help him through that process. But he's exactly right. It's so much more cost effective to have a one-time genetic test, find out if a person is at risk and has that predisposing mutation or not, versus doing echocardiogram and EKG and maybe other cardiac tests for a person's lifetime when they may not have even inherited the mutation in the family.
And all of their family members, right?
Exactly.
Jeffrey in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Hi, I have a quick question about with getting your genetics sequenced and getting the test done for an individual, could this lead to an individual being marked by a genetic scarlet letter, in essence? If they are predisposed to one of these type of illnesses. And I'll actually take my comment off the air.
Okay, Jeffrey, thanks. Amy? Sturm?
You know, some of what we've talked about with the federal legislation and protections through GINA, the way that works is if a person is unaffected, they currently do not have symptoms for the disease in question, yet they then have a genetic test saying that they have a marker, a variant, or a mutation that could lead them to develop that in the future. Basically, what that law states is that that type of marker cannot be considered a pre-existing condition by an insurance company. Same thing with family history information. If your dad died at 40 from a heart attack, that's in your family history, yet that's not in your own history, and that shouldn't be considered a pre-existing condition against you. So I do think we have good federal protections for health insurance discrimination regarding pre-existing condition and how your genetic information applies. However, we do have those gaps with no protections for life insurance discrimination or the long-term care or short or disability insurance. And so I think we do have to be careful and make sure patients know exactly what could or could not be, you know, potentially be used against them in the future if they have these type of tests.
Richard in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Hi. I am a 78-year-old man with a lifelong asthma condition. Staticus asthmaticus, as one of my doctors described it, and I've almost died several times in my life. Is there any genetic testing that covers this area, and would I be a candidate to be included in your study?
Asthma is one of those conditions that is very complex from a genetic standpoint, and I think we are just starting to learn a little bit more about some both common and rare variants that could predispose individuals to asthma. We do have a few remaining open spots in what we kind of call our community cohort for the CORIEL study, and you can find out more information about that by visiting the Center for Personalized Healthcare website at Ohio State.
The website is centralized?
It's the Center for Personalized Healthcare.
We'll, Thomas, we'll post that on our website at WOSU. I'm sorry, Richard, we'll post that at WOSU.org.
Center for Personalized Healthcare.
Correct, yes.
Right. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, all right.
Thanks,
Richard. We're running out of time. It always happens. 614-292-8513. If you want to squeeze in a phone call, though, we'll see if we can get to it. An email from Carol. She says, when having genetic profiling concerning a specific disease such as cancer, is it possible that these indicators alone would come back as non-existent, giving the participant a false sense of security, causing them to ignore traditional warning signs, when in truth other factors may still contribute to the condition?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, when we see patients, for example, like this emailer brought up with cancer genetic testing, and we go through their family and we test them, and you know, maybe they come back negative for the mutation that's running in their family, just say, for example, giving an increased risk for breast cancer. We always caution people, you know, this is great news for you. This means that you don't have this very high hereditary risk for breast cancer running in your family. That being said, you still need to get mammograms. You are not ever at 0% risk for any disease, even if you don't have the strong genetic factor in your family. So it's, of course, still very important for people to follow the general guidelines that anyone would follow, mammograms at age 40, colonoscopy at age 50, and live a healthy lifestyle, and also screen for other diseases like diabetes and heart disease that we know can affect so many individuals. And we do try to make sure that people don't get too much of a false sense of security with getting these results. And I do think that's another concern that has been brought up by the direct-to-consumer results, because the patient I counseled, he got back his result and it said he had a quote-unquote typical risk for heart disease. Well, when I sat down and took his family tree, he had very significant high-risk family history for heart disease.
You know, Michelle McGowan, that I wanted to ask, I mean, should, as far as regulating these genetic testing companies doing that are doing the direct-to-consumer testing, should genetic counseling be part of the package? Only a handful do it right now, and even then, that's not regulated either.
Right. So this is a very interesting question. And since I've been studying this phenomenon about 4 years now, there has been a great move, a trend towards moving away from the direct-to-consumer provision of genomic risk profiling to a direct-to-provider model, which is when the people who are interested in getting that test have to order it through a doctor. And so then there is a medical loop in, either with genetic counseling through the companies. The companies typically have a genetic counselor on retainer, or through a clinician so that they can actually get some counseling about the results and what they mean, so that hopefully there would be some more situations like the one that Amy described, where individuals would be able to combine their family health history with the results of the genomic risk profiling, because together they are more powerful than separately.
Thomas and Worthington, we're running out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in. Thanks for joining
sure.
the show.
I can make it real fast.
Okay.
Basically, I have a 5-year-old son who has Down syndrome, and that is a genetic condition, not necessarily a health condition. When he turns 18, no insurance company will touch him, and I want to know if that's legal, basically, under the 2008 law, which says you can't disqualify under, you know, genetic, you know, for genetic reasons.
Michelle?
Well, actually, I don't know the answer to this question, so maybe Amy would have a better answer about the specific condition.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, from my best understanding of the federal law, it applies to individuals who may have a test that is telling them something that might happen in the future. It's not necessarily applied to individuals who have a current diagnosis of a condition. That being said, of course, I think an insurance company not to insure your son is absolutely wrong. But I don't know if that law could be utilized to help, because really it's meant for individuals who, say, go through genetic testing because their mom had breast cancer at age 50 and now they're going to, you know, have testing in their 20s to find out if they also have that risk. It's meant to really protect that type of predictive genetic testing for the future. But for people who already have a genetic diagnosis, that's another gap.
And the question of whether that's covered in the federal healthcare reform act is still up in the air. And we'll be talking about that in another show. Thanks to everybody for listening. Amy Sturm, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Amy is certified genetics counselor and assistant professor of human genetics at OSU Department of Internal Medicine. Michelle McGowan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Michelle McGowan is an assistant professor of bioethics at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.